I could build and staff a new high school or a new major nursing center every day of the year for the next 2,500 years with just the money that the countries of our world spent on armaments last year. Anyone in his right mind must be committed to the principle of arms control and disarmament. We spent last year in this world something less than $230 per child for schooling. We sent last year nearly $15,000 per soldier to teach him to kill. The funds that are spent for destruction and the weapons of destruction are astronomical. We mock sometimes the ancient Egyptians because they plowed back their treasure into tombs for dead pharaohs. But what are we doing except to plow back our treasure to put people, hundreds of millions of people, into tombs? There is enough power, deadly power, in the shells and the destructive devices which have been created by modern man in our world today, in the armories of our world today, to provide 15,000 pounds of explosive power to kill every man, woman, and child on the face of this earth. Someplace the Talmud asks, Ezehu Shoteh, who is a fool? And the answer is, Mi shema'abed kol shenotnim lo. A fool is the person who wastes everything that is given to him. Nearly 20% of the gross world product, the value of the sum total of goods and services produced by our world, is spent on armaments for destruction. Now, as you know, a great debate is about to take place in the United States over a SALT II treaty, which this administration has been telling us for weeks is about to be completed, negotiations for which are about to be completed with the Soviet Union. SALT is an acronym for Strategic Arms Limitations Treaty. And this treaty has been negotiated for the United States by an arms limitation and disarmament agency. And the President of the United States has been sponsoring this treaty as a contribution to arms limitation and to disarmament. Many are opposed to the treaty. There's come into being in the last months a committee for peace through security, a group of representatives of the military and defense departments, the military industrial complex, others, who argue that under its terms, the Russians will be given a decided advantage in the arms, in the list of arms that are governed by the treaty. They will gain more than we will gain. And our own Senator Glenn has become the point man in a long discussion, which is sure to rage on, as to whether, in fact, the treaty is verifiable. We have lost the electronic eavesdropping stations, which we had in Iran, and there's a serious question, apparently, whether or not we will know whether the Russians live up to the terms of the treaty. Now, both of these groups have a basis for their argument. But I would suggest to you that the great debate will not take is not taking place over arms control or disarmament. It's taking place over a treaty which has nothing to do with disarmament or arms control, but is rather a reshaping of the arms race so that the two great powers can spend less for arms of marginal advantage now and can spend more on arms which give them a greater possibility for technical advance. Neither Mr. Carter and the administration, nor Senator Glenn and those who worry about verification, nor the Committee for Peace Through Strength, none of these groups is addressing the issue which this administration suggests is involved basically in the SALT II treaty. When all is said and done, SALT II just sets the ground rules for intensified competition, continued massive arms buildup. Whatever else it is or is not, it is not a contribution to arms control or to disarmament. And unfortunately, the American people are being led to believe that the treaty is something which it is not. Let me review a little bit of history with you, because I think that we need the history fresh in our minds in order to understand where we are. At the end of the Second World War, the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics emerged as the two uncontested superpowers. And between the two powers, the United States was preeminent militarily, for we had a nuclear monopoly. It took the Soviet Union about 10 years to create an effective nuclear arms system. And it took them another 15 years or so to get to the point where they had relative nuclear armament parity with the United States. Now, the United States in the first 25 or 28 years after the Second World War spent over $1 trillion in research and development and the manufacture of sophisticated weapons. The Soviets spent far more, because they embarked upon a forced march to bring themselves to a basis of military parity with the United States. Each morning we awake to what seems to be a peaceful world. But I remind you that such peace as exists in our world does not exist because the nations of the world are reasonably and rationally committed to settle their problems and their differences by negotiation, but because of what is called the doctrine of deterrence, which is a very childish doctrine, which says simply, you won't kill me, because if you do, I'll kill you in the process. Winston Churchill many years ago described this grand international system of ours is a balance of terror. Simply put, Russia will not strike at the United States because we would strike back. And if her missiles destroyed our city, our missiles would destroy her cities. We have the power to destroy the Soviet Union 20 times over, and the Soviet Union has the power to destroy the United States 20 times over or more. Our international relationships are primitive, to say the least, of the jungle. And we awaken each morning to another day of whatever our routines may be, many of us confident that there'll always be another day and another day for us and for our children, unaware of the missiles in the silos, the warheads at ready, nuclear devices which are within 20 minutes of destroying all that we know and all whom we love. Now, once the Soviet Union and the United States achieved this condition of relative nuclear parity, or at least it became apparent that the Soviets would soon achieve nuclear parity, they began, each of the superpowers, to assess its position in the world. They had spent over $1 trillion apiece on armaments. Countries which had not made the same amount of defense investment were forging ahead, were more prosperous, were stronger. In the West, the two countries which were deliberately disarmed in terms of these kinds of nuclear weapons, Germany and Japan, had become strong powers because they've been able to use their prosperity for the things which make them even ever more prosperous. China was beginning to challenge the Soviet Union. And so the United States and the Soviet Union began to wonder whether they could plunge ahead as recklessly as they had before, build everything, do every kind of research and development which could be conceived of, which might give them the least little bit of advantage in the armaments race. And in the late 1960s, it became clear to the United States and to the Soviet Union, both that in terms of the cost of weaponry, it was becoming debilitating to their economies and to their position of power, and a new generation of weapons was coming into being, which was particularly disturbing in terms of the cost which it suggested. These were the anti-ballistic missiles, missile systems which could be erected in the United States and around the border of the United States, in the Soviet Union and around the borders of the Soviet world, whose purpose it would be to strike down as many of the incoming intercontinental ballistic missiles as they possibly could. Now, the whole doctrine of deterrence, of the balance of terror, is based on the fact that if you kill me, I kill you. If I have a defensive screen against these weapons, and I can begin to shoot down a number of them, somebody in one of these countries is going to begin to say, as did the RAND Corporation and others, well, we'll only suffer 75 million casualties in the first strike. We'll be able to strike back, and in the second strike, we will utterly destroy the other country, the enemy, whoever it is, and we will have the advantage in a devastated world. The anti-ballistic missile system that was being proposed at the time was relatively crude and terribly expensive. It would have cost nearly half of what had already been spent on an offensive system in order to build it, with relatively insignificant results. And there was always a counter move that could be made, and that was simply to build more silos and put more missiles in more silos and simply send more missiles across at the other country, because ultimately a number of these missiles would get through. There was a danger for an unbridled escalation in the number of missiles, and they would be of marginal value in terms of deterrence instead of killing the other. And so in 1970, the Soviet Union and United States concluded the first SALT treaty. They proclaimed it to be an arms limitations and disarmament treaty. In fact, it had very little to do with arms limitation and disarmament. It had more to do with cost containment. It was an attempt by the two superpowers to husband wealth, not to have to spend it for weapons of limited value, given the degree of technology of the time, so that other countries would not begin to contest the role of superpowers by moving quickly to the developments of a few very highly sophisticated nuclear weapons. SALT II was signed in 1970, the Vladivostok Agreement, which essentially described the terms of SALT II, was signed in 1972. It is now 1979. And if you want to measure the effectiveness of SALT I as an arms control or disarmament treaty, I suggest simply you look at one figure. Both the Soviet Union and the United States have today three times the nuclear destructive power that they had in 1970. What happened? The SALT treaty limited the anti-ballistic missile system, which was crude and expensive, and it set some limits on the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Each country had about 2,000 and a few hundred of these. But science proceeds. One of the overwhelming facts of the arms race is simply this. 500,000 scientists and engineers are involved in the arms race. of all the scientists and engineers on the face of the globe. With money, with brains, with technical skill, any weapon can be countered or improved upon. And if under SALT I, each country could only have 2,000 and a few hundred nuclear warhead missiles at the ready, well, we'll create something called MIRV. Not MIRV Griffin, but a multiple individually targeted reentry vehicle that is a missile whose warhead is not one warhead, but three or four. Each of them capable of being individually targeted once the missile has been lifted from its platform. So that one missile sent from these shores towards the Soviet Union could have a missile, a warhead, a nuclear warhead targeted, one for Kiev, one for Moscow, and one for Leningrad. Targeted to a degree of proficiency so that each of these missiles would fall within 600 yards of the predetermined target. And obviously what's good for the goose is sauce for the gander. One Soviet multiple warhead missile can be targeted at the United States, and one of its warheads will destroy Cleveland, and another will destroy New York, and another would destroy Washington. So though the two countries retained only the number of missiles that they had, approximately the number, they multiplied by three the destructive power which was available. And I would remind you that the SALT I treaty covered only a very narrow range of intercontinental missiles. It didn't have to do, it said nothing about conventional weapons. It said nothing about the new kinds of high-energy weapons which were being developed. It said nothing about nuclear warheads on mortars or shells which had a trajectory of 600 miles or 800 miles instead of 3,000 or 5,000 miles. And so each country plunged ahead with these new multiple warhead missiles, and we began to develop mobile platforms for launching the missiles because it was easy to target weapons at missiles which were fixed in the ground. And we developed the very expensive atomic submarine fleet that we have, and the Soviet developed one of their own. We began to develop what's called an MX missile, which is simply on an automobile tank kind of tractor, which can be moved here, there, wherever you want to move it. We in the Soviet Union doing the same thing. The SALT I treaty, which was ballyhooed as a contribution to arms control and disarmament, simply increased the destructive power, the kill power of the two superpowers by a factor of three. And what troubles me is that this new SALT treaty, the so-called SALT II, when it is finally negotiated, when it is submitted to the Senate, is of the same ilk. It will not limit arms. If you measure arms by the total destructive capacity of a nation, it will limit certain kinds of armaments, which the two countries have decided between them can no longer be usefully developed beyond a certain point. It's a cost containment program, not a program which is a contribution to disarmament and peace in that sense. What does the SALT II treaty say? It says that over a period of 5 years, the Soviet Union and the United States will limit the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles that they will have at the ready to some 2,100. It says they will limit the number of multiple warhead missiles to 1,300 and some. And just those basic figures represent an increase of 50 for the United States and some 200 or 250 for the Soviet Union. It says nothing about the sub-intercontinental weapons, which are now being developed, the so-called Soviet backfire bomber, whose range is just a few miles short of intercontinental. It says nothing about our MX missiles, which are highly mobile land missiles. It says nothing about the amount of destructive power which may be in any warhead. It says nothing about the number of nuclear weapons which can be in more conventional arms, cannons, mortars, even fired from a gun. There will be more destructive power in the world in 1985 than there is today. What may happen because of the SALT II treaty is that the two countries will not have to do everything, and they can concentrate on those parts of the arms race which seem to them to be particularly advantageous to them. And so the world plunges ahead towards Armageddon, because anyone who knows anything about history knows that any arms race which has ever been begun has led ultimately to those arms being used. And the arms which we now have in our possession, which the Soviet has in their possession, and which France has in their possession, which China has in their possession, which England has in their possession, will soon be matched by similar arms which Gaddafi will have in his possession and Assad will have in his possession, and until a week ago Amin could very well have had in his possession. In the process of this untrammeled arms race, the two nuclear powers have proliferated. And there are 9 or 10. And by 1990, there'll be 40 or 50. And though the United States and the Soviet Union like to think of themselves as responsible agents of terror, and Gaddafi and Assad and Amin as irresponsible agents of terror, not to be trusted, wild men who would do anything, who's wild and who's sane in the kind of world which I am describing? When you look at SALT II, you tear away the blinders from your eyes and you recognize the kind of world we really live in. SALT II makes has no prohibition against high-energy weapons, anti-satellite weapons, particle beam weapons, laser beam weapons, all the next generation of vicious weapons. And I'm told that there are so-called non-nuclear weapons. The word, the euphemism they use are conventional weapons, whose destructive power is greater than that of the hydrogen bomb. Now, whether or not this is the case, the capacity which exists in our world to destroy the world many times over is capacity where the decision rests in the power of a very few men and women, but mostly men. And who knows if, when, and for what reason this power might be used. I'm going to be a disinterested spectator at the great SALT II debate. I don't think it makes a particle of difference who wins. If there is no SALT II treaty, the arms race will gallop ahead. If there is a SALT II treaty, the arms race will gallop ahead. Perhaps there may be some marginal benefit diplomatically to have ongoing conversations between the Soviet Union and United States of this kind. But there's no evidence, given the Soviet pattern of behavior in the last 9 or 10 years, that having had a SALT I treaty and working towards a SALT II treaty, having met periodically for these purposes, there's been any restraint by the Soviet Union in terms of its expansionist hopes and desires and plans throughout the world. And certainly the United States has maintained its defense posture and has, when it wanted to, has thrown its planes here or there for its own particular purpose. If we've not been as expansionist as the Soviet Union, perhaps it's simply that we're a little less apt than they are. On the other hand, it may be that there's some advantage in this SALT II debate, that perhaps the American people and others throughout the world will get up and begin to say to their leaders, don't pull the wool over our eyes. Don't talk to us of arms limitation, disarmament, when that's not the issue. We believe in arms limitation, disarmament. And let's find the ways, if ways can be found, to move ahead. But talk to us honestly. If you're talking about cost containment, we can understand it. But don't talk to us of peace when the issue is not peace, but greater destructive power. President Carter, when he was running for office, attacked the Nixon-Ford administration in SALT I, and he said, and I quote, SALT I provides just the ground rules for intensified competition and continued massive arms growth. And these words could be flung back into his face today, because that's all that SALT II promises to provide. In the history of the world, there has never been a successful arms control program. You may remember 1922. There was the Washington Naval Conference, which time the great powers of the world got together to deal with the intercontinental ballistic missiles of their day, which were the great dreadnought battleships, which were essentially fighting platforms from whose cannon shells could be lobbed 50 or 100 miles into and beyond any coastline in the world. And very careful rules were established as to how big a ship could be and how big the bore of a cannon on a ship could be. And the countries of the world were limited to the number of battleships they could build. And the question of verifiability was fairly easy because a battleship takes a long time to build and it has to be built in a dry dock, and even a man with a binoculars could discover whether the Newport News dry dock or the Firth of Forth dry dock or a dry dock someplace else was building a dreadnought. So what happened? America became bemused with the fact that there was an arms limitation program in being. And German scientists discovered a way to build a heavy cruiser 2 feet shorter than what the ships that were classified as battleships by the Washington Naval Agreement, and to put into smaller bore as effective a shell as had been in the larger bore cannon. And they built that generation of pocket battleships, which were really, they called cruisers, which ravaged the seas at the beginning of the Second World War, the Scharnhorst, Nisenau, some of these other ships. Science will always find a way around the most carefully constructed set of rules that any group of political and diplomatic draftsmen can concoct. That's very clear. Our scientists found the way around SALT I. Their scientists found the way around SALT I. Our scientists will find the way around SALT II. Their scientists will find the way around SALT II. Disarmament will occur not when the hard-headed military types of our world get together and work out the terms of disarmament, but when the people of the world, through their leaders, get together and decide that there are not going to be armed borders. That there are going to be areas like the Great Lakes where there'll be no military ships. That the United States and Canada will not maintain defensive positions facing each other across the borders. Peace will come when the countries of the world want to live in peace and learn that in this small planet we call Earth, war is no longer a viable option. Once upon a time, war killed only the people who went to war, or the few civilians who had the bad fortune to be in the path of the troops that were at war. In 1979, a war will kill everyone within 100 miles of where a missile with a nuclear warhead drops. The RAND Corporation speaks of acceptable costs where only 100 million Americans would die in a first strike. Only 100 million. There is no acceptability to war today. And if we could only learn that really none of us can hope to take over what the other has, then and then only will there be arms control and disarmament. But I must say that there is no evidence any place in our world that the leadership of the world or the fellowship is ready for arms control and disarmament. Instead, the clear pattern of our world is an expansionist one. The Soviet Union into Africa and into Asia, China to Southeast Asia, the United States into Latin America, one Latin American country, one African country into another African country. It's only a matter of size. Every country wants more than it has now, if not actual physical control, a sphere of influence. And it can't be. Because as sure as we are here today, in a year, or 5, or 10 perhaps, somebody is going to be angry enough to press some button, and the missiles will fly, and the nuclear disaster will occur. 3 weeks ago, we became concerned, and we should have been concerned, that a little bit of radioactive waste escaped from the 3 Mile Island generator. The amount of nuclear active substance that escaped is infinitesimal compared to the amount of fissionable material which will be released by one bomb falling on the face of this earth. And we're not talking about one bomb. Under SALT II, just on its intercontinental ballistic missiles, the United States will have 9,000 warheads. 9,000 nuclear warheads, and the Soviet Union will have an equal number. And no one knows how many nuclear warheads France has, or England has, or China has, or Israel has, or Egypt has. You may have read 3 weeks ago that a group of unknown saboteurs broke into a storage area in the Marseille docks and destroyed a nuclear reactor which was being sent from France to Iraq. Imagine a government like Iraq having nuclear weapons. But they'll have them. And Iraq could well say, what makes you think, Washington or Moscow, that you are any more responsible than we are as to the management of such weaponry? And so I say this simply, that whatever way the SALT II debate goes, and you'll be overwhelmed with complex technical details by one side or the other, forget them. Leave those to the technicians. The question is simply this. Are you willing to be sold by your government an arms limitation treaty, which is no arms limitation treaty? Are you willing to accept from your government a cost containment treaty, which has certain advantages to the American taxpayer? Perhaps. Look at the treaty in those terms and recognize deep down that SALT I and SALT II represent the failure of any kind of meaningful international arrangements emerging on the face of our Earth. They're not a statement of success, but a failure. They represent the determination of both countries to increase their military power, not to decrease it. And they do so because both are frightened and concerned and anxious about the actions of the other. I would hope that this administration would be honest enough to talk to the American people in realistic terms about this treaty. I don't think they will be. But surely we are wise enough to know what is happening and wise enough to judge it accordingly. The rabbis say that every lecture should end on a word of hope. What hope do we have? Well, where there's life, there's hope. And that's our hope. Amen.
Thank you. glory is revealed in the heavens above, and whose greatness is manifest throughout the world. He is our God, there is none else. King of kings, the Holy One, praise be He.
May the time not be distant, O God, when thy name shall be worshipped in all the earth, when unbelief shall disappear and error be no more. Fervently we pray the day may come when all men shall invoke thy name, when corruption and evil shall give way to purity and goodness, when superstition shall no longer enslave the mind, nor idolatry blind the eye, when all who dwell on earth shall know to thee alone every knee must bend and every tongue give homage. O may all created in thine image recognize that they are brethren, so that one in spirit and one in fellowship they may be forever united before thee. Then shall thy kingdom be established on earth.